dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, I said we'd finish the series of readings from Charles Eisenstein's book, The Ascent of Humanity. Well, it turns out not quite, because I couldn't make everything fit into the exactly 1 hour and 59 minutes this show is required to occupy, no more, no less. In the age of reunion, radio shows will get to be whatever length they need to be, and not have to deform themselves to a predetermined clock. Everything we do is subject, even in subtle ways, to the machine ideology of mass production, and nothing more so than the system of schooling, which figures prominently in Eisenstein's book, and will be the topic of two interviews in the first hour. Ken McDermott Rowe is the host of History Counts on WPKN in Connecticut, and he thinks, as I do, that our aspirations are crippled by our lack of grasp of real history, which reaches us during schooling in a highly filtered and distorted form that has a definite agenda. The first of Ken's interviews is with a man mentioned by Eisenstein and whose book, The Underground History of American Education, I read on the show some years ago. He is John Taylor Gatto. Here's Ken McDermott Rowe.
We're very fortunate to have as our guest the educator, author, and lecturer John Taylor Gatto. Mr. Gatto taught in New York City public schools for 30 years. He was named New York City Teacher of the Year in 1989, 1990, and 1991. And in 1991, he was also named New York State Teacher of the Year. Since leaving public school teaching, Mr. Gatto has been a tireless advocate for school reform. He's traveled over 3 million miles to lecture on the subject in all 50 states and 7 foreign countries. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Underground History of American Education, and most recently, Weapons of Mass Instruction, A Schoolteacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. Mr. Gatto is currently working on a documentary film about the nature of modern schooling entitled The Fourth Purpose. And his website is www.johntaylor.com. Well, Mr. Gatto, thanks very much for joining us today. Could you take us back in time and describe how Americans were educated in the colonial era and the early years of the American Republic?
Sure. The best reference for this would be two books, both very famous. One, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and the other would be a gloriously written survey of America by a French aristocrat, Alexis de Tocqueville, called Democracy in America. They will be in every library in the United States. If you spend some time with both, you'll discover, A, that childhood hardly existed, that it existed up to the age of about 7, and after that, people were not only expected to carry their share of the load, but they were trusted to do that. So Ben Franklin, not from a wealthy family at all, from a family of, I believe, 15 kids, candlemaker as a father, was traveling back and forth to England and the continent in his early teen years. He also was working 60-hour week, and in addition to that, with his friends, putting themselves through an education at the age of about 12, that I believe Yale and Harvard would be reluctant to try to force on their own undergraduates today.
Did he have any formal schooling?
Franklin had 2 years of it. He was thrown out of both schools he attended because he was a bad boy. What that translates into is that he couldn't stand the limitation of opportunity that schooling offered. And the truth is, back in those days, very few people could. School would occupy, 90 days a year and a maximum of 2 hours in a seat. Now, it was nothing at all like what we have today, and there was quite a palette of different types of schooling available, but I would say the American ideal, regardless of the social class, was self-schooling. The idea was that you could undertake your own education, and no one would give it to you. You would take it by examining your own talents, your own weaknesses, and then matching those things up to opportunities to learn in the culture. It's very much like the unschoolers in the homeschooling community today. They trust their kids, and if someone listening is skeptical, let me tell you that the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, was an unschooler who studied whatever he felt like studying for as long as he felt like studying it. His mother only insisted that his other three brothers, all different ages, had to agree what the four of them would study. Other than that, she stayed out of the way. He shot through Harvard, with star performance and shot to the top of the scientific world. There can't be a project in science today that's even close in terms of prestige.
So Ben Franklin's schooling in the 18th century was not atypical. A lot of people would have had his type of education.
Oh, a great many. In fact, if you read his autobiography, you'll see that whatever Franklin did, most of his friends were doing too. I mean, they would sometimes join together. One of the things they did was they figured out that if you couldn't hold an audience communicating in writing, that you were in a lot of trouble where maximum opportunity was concerned. And they came to the conclusion that having a style that would grasp a reader's attention and hold it was important. So where were they going to get a style? Well, they picked the best stylists of the day, and they created this project for themselves. I would urge somebody listening to do this with their own kid today. They would try to rewrite an essay by someone with a good style in their own words until a third party looking at it would say, oh, you must have taken this from the New Yorker, or some other high-style publication. And then they would realize that they had mastered style A, style B, style C. The autobiography is full of similar suggestions. When they were learning science, they actually did real scientific experiments. Nowhere in the United States today does that happen in a school. Even in the famous science schools, what happens is you imitate an experiment that everybody knows what the result's going to be. I mean, we're training clerks in the sciences rather than scientists.
Well, this form of schooling was later eclipsed, and you traced the origin of the modern American school system to a Napoleonic battle that took place in Europe in 1806. Could you please explain?
Sure. First, I think it's important that your listeners understand that Napoleon's armies were amateur armies. Germany, northern Germany, the military state of Prussia was quite unlike that. Everybody lifted their fork at the same time, so they were used to winning all their battles. And when Napoleon menaced Prussia, it was assumed that it would be an open and shut victory for Prussia. Instead, Napoleon's armies at the Battle of Jena, that's J-E-N-A, in 1806, wiped out the Prussian army. That was a lot more important than simply losing a battle, because the chief cash income of the state of Prussia was renting out soldiers to other countries, and you can't get a good price for your soldiers if they get whipped by an amateur like Napoleon. So at that moment, a national panic ensued, and a famous philosopher from the University of Berlin, Johann Fichte, that's spelled F-I-C-H-T-E, demanded publicly of the Prussian king that this never happen again. He said this happened because people thought for themselves. And he suggested, in fact, demanded a new institution of universal forced schooling where everyone would be on the page that the boss wanted them to be on. And after years and years of this kind of drill and testing, the army would dependably follow the orders it was given. Prussia pulled it off by marching the kids to school at bayonet point, and as a consequence, turning lives into human resources. And a leader then can focus the human resources, confident that there'll be no contradictions. That works with a factory economy. Does not work to give the majority of people good lives, but it does work to build wealth and to give great wealth to the leadership, the management.
So the education is oriented towards the interest of the state, not towards the interest of the individual
student.
The
interest of the state and also the interest of the dominant economy, making it more efficient. When Prussian schooling came to the United States big time, it was brought here by Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, Harriman. I mean, they front some poor chump named Horace Mann, who loved the Prussians, just loved them. But in fact, Mann was a politician who had no interest whatsoever in children or schooling. He was promised a seat in the American Congress if he could pull off forced schooling, and he did, and he got his seat in Congress.
Well, now, Horace Mann was a Massachusetts politician and lawyer. He was patronized by these industrialists. Did they send him to Prussia?
They sent him to Prussia. He dawdled on the way over, and when he got there, the schools were closed. So he was now faced with the prospect of returning to his backers in Massachusetts saying, sorry, I goofed up. No, he didn't do that. He came back and he said that what he had seen was paradise on earth. It was a utopia. You can read what he said in his seventh letter to the Boston school community. And he says, we must have Prussian schooling, which, of course, he had never seen.
Well, now, this is back in 1843, and then, as I understand it, he set to work with some of the industrialists and leading politicians to try to enact a law.
Peabody was the first one. The use of children in the industrial phase of America's history was critical. It was essential. And Peabody was a very large railroad magnate, and also he owned a number of coal mines. So the railroads and the coal mines, they worked in tandem. The major force of coal miners in the United States, I know this will strike some of your listeners as bizarre, but it was small children, because the tunnels, the coal-bearing tunnels, were so small that 8 and 9 year old children, boys and girls, were the ideal people to crawl into them and hack away with their little picks. Quickly, this set of economic interests realized that what they would have to do to keep their future secure was to draw the children out of the entire community and habit and attitude train them in schooling, and Prussia was the only working model.
So in 1852, Massachusetts adopted a compulsory education law, and you're right, the rest of the states followed eventually.
Well, but the eventually is the key word there. New York followed immediately. Washington, D.C. followed immediately, and that's it. 15 years passed, no one else followed. How did the break come where one by one the other states fell in line? Well, the key is that Washington, D.C. was on board, and as we know now, Washington has the ability to print as much money as it needs to lay bribes around for compliant states. So we didn't get the last state in line until 1918.
Well, there was considerable opposition to the notion of compulsory education.
There was an enormous opposition to it. In Massachusetts, at one juncture, children were marched to school at bayonet point. I mean, what was recognized at first is that productive human beings had to become unproductive. Kids whose successful lives were based on making multiple connections in the society were disconnected not only from opportunity, but from their own families, their own traditions, their own religions.
Yeah, you'd quote Elwood Cubberley, the dean of a Stanford School of Education, and he wrote, quote, "Each year the child is coming to belong more and more to the state and less to the parent." That was in 1909 in Conceptions of Education.
Yeah, Cubberley said in his doctoral thesis at University of Columbia that the new type of schooling would shape and fashion the young like nails, so that, you know, they could be used in any industrial application. But he became the head of a national shadow organization called the Cleveland Conference. You can read about this in a very intellectual textbook called Managers of Virtue. The author is David Tyack, T-Y-A-C-K, and Cubberley took charge, once again, hold on to your hat, of every major administrative job in the United States, north, south, east, and west. And his shadowy Cleveland Conference would select, coming up through the ranks, those people willing to play ball with the new system of compulsory schooling that was intended to be the right arm, the strong right arm of government and corporate America.
How does it relate to the famous book Principles of Scientific Management by Frederick W. Taylor, published in 1911?
This idea that people were predictable machine parts was brought into industry by Frederick Taylor, who was a Prussian-trained social engineer. He invented what still exists called time and motion study. You must reduce the components of a system to a mathematically predictable conformity. So this became one of the major goals of the new institutional schooling. Now, parents weren't told this. You know, the bells just started to ring every 43 minutes. The standardized tests, which were intended to standardize, they have nothing to do with quality at all. I mean, it's a misapprehension to think the words high standards and standardizations are related to one another.
This came from Hugo Munsterberg from
Yes, Munsterberg at Harvard. But this was an international movement that eventually the United States took command of because we were so successful. I think the great irony is that our success was based on a kind of endless ingenuity, and this kind of a system destroys ingenuity, but because of the legacy of past generations, we still were immensely ingenious. So you only have to look at the steep drop in the number of patents attributed to Americans to realize what these decades of forced schooling have done to us. We've dropped from 90% of the world's total in 1939 to about 27% today, and the curve is steeply inclined downward.
You talked about the important role that John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie played in the evolution of the new system. One of the ways you point out is through founding places like Teachers College at Columbia, where they trained the future presidents of teacher colleges.
Well, not only Teachers College. I can give you Teachers College, Johns Hopkins, Yale University, University of Wisconsin, Stanford on the West Coast. All of these schools brought the German system to the United States. And because they had a great deal of prestige, because the kind of families they recruited for their student body, other universities were really heavily influenced to follow suit. But Carnegie was not content to rely on the force of example. He and Rockefeller joined together in the early part of the 20th century and created a private organization called the General Education Board. And the General Education Board offered for the first time pensions to college teachers, but only if the college would adopt the Carnegie credit system, which was this rigid apportioning of so many hours spent with language, so many hours spent with number. I mean, it still exists, although it's somewhat weaker than it once was. So that in a short time, every place in the country, high schools couldn't get their kids in college unless they followed the Carnegie system. But even the majority of private schools assumed that this had been scientifically arrived at. It wasn't at all. It was based on a sophisticated understanding of how a small group can impose its will on a large group.
And this really ties in with the principles of secondary education by Alexander Inglis, which is make people more manageable.
Inglis was big time as you get, and as a consequence, nobody who thinks they know something about modern schooling has ever heard of Inglis. When Inglis gets to Harvard, Harvard names its honor lecture in education after Alexander Inglis, and it's still in existence and still called the Inglis Lecture. Inglis was also the head of Houghton Mifflin's secondary school publishing division, and by the way, the head of their elementary school publishing division was Elwood P. Coverley. So that was the major textbook producer back in the 1920s. And Inglis laid down in a book called Principles of Secondary Education the actual functions that schooling had to serve. I'll just throw a few of them out. One was you had to make everybody, whether so-called gifted and talented or a dummy, absolutely predictable, because business depended on being able to predict what color in fashion the ladies would wear that fall, etc., etc. And therefore, you had to rig the game by making people predictable, by getting rid of their independent opinion.
The idea of ranking people and dividing them by age, which was completely different from the Ben Franklin system, was something really important in the principles of secondary education.
We're talking Julius Caesar here. What Caesar's Gallic Wars is about is how a small group of people can divide and conquer a large group of people by setting them against one another in petty competitions. That's what school structure is about. There's an infinite number of ways you make winners and losers and the mediocre.
How does that make it useful then to business?
Because it makes managers in charge the only thing that matters to underlings. A pat on the back, an extra dollar in the paycheck, an office on the shady side of the building. It makes management semi-godlike, because your inner life is destroyed. You live to climb on the backs of who should be your natural allies. You've been divided from them. You've been divided from your family, divided from your religion, divided from your culture, divided from anyone who isn't exactly your same age or reading score in a standardized examination. You don't recover from that.
What are the implications of that system on how effective a democracy functions?
If people who are natural allies associate with one another and exercise their political franchise, they can, in fact, take over the system. So how can you seem to maintain a democratic structure, but in fact poison it at the root? Well, simply by dividing people against one another and putting them in constant competition with one another, it works to allow management to have its cake. Hey, we're a democracy, and eat it too.
Well, Congress did make findings which were very critical of big business control over education in 1913 and again in 1954 with the Reese Committee. Did anything come of these reports?
Nothing. The Walsh Committee and the other one was the Reese Commission. The Reese Commission, and it found the same things that Walsh did, that the policy of schools is decided inside of about 12 private corporate foundations like Rockefeller or Carnegie or these days Gates. And inside these foundations, decisions are made about what school kids will study and how many will be tracked into the corporate world and how many into the industrial, and so on and so on. Both these congressional investigations made those same discoveries, and nothing else happened except school enlarged its reach, its depth, the amount of money it removes from the purchasing power of the public for operation. Every time we've increased the amount of money we give schools, they get worse. If you say to yourself, wherever you are listening to this program, that everything I think I know about schooling is not true, everything I know about school is wrong, you'll be much better off than saying, well, I understand how this works.
Well, do you think it's feasible or practical to end compulsory schooling?
You can end it from the bottom up, because what ordinary parents think of as an education, in fact, can be mastered, can be taken on your own the way Ben Franklin did it. And Franklin's friends did it.
John Taylor Gatto, interviewed by Ken McDermott Rowe, who will also interview the next guest.
Are American students getting the true story about their own history? To answer this question, we're pleased to have as our guest today a scholar who spent 2 years evaluating 12 leading high school textbooks on American history. My guest today is Professor James Lowen, and we're going to talk about his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong. Jim Lowen received a PhD in sociology from Harvard. He taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont, and previously he taught at predominantly black Tougaloo College in Mississippi. Jim Lowen's other books include Mississippi, Conflict and Change, Sundown Towns, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. He's currently working on Surprises on the Landscape, Unexpected Places That Get History Right. Lies My Teacher Told Me received the American Book Award in 1996. It was recently republished by Touchstone, and it sold over 800,000 copies. Thanks for joining us, Professor Lowen.
It'll be my pleasure, I'm sure.
Jim, could you talk to us about the methodology involved in reviewing the textbooks that constituted the basis for your book?
Yes. I got into this project because of some because of an aha experience I had in Mississippi, or I may better call it an oh-no experience. I was teaching at Tougaloo College, as you mentioned. That's a historically black and overwhelmingly black school. And my first year teaching there, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also teaching one section of what was called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. Now, this was a course set up by the history department to introduce students to all of the social sciences, and it did so in the context of African-American history, which made sense, being as 99% of our students were African-American. Now, that's the same chronology as American history, of course, and in that chronology, second semester begins right after Reconstruction, with the period known as, right after the Civil War, with the period known as Reconstruction. So I had a new group of students that second semester, and I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class, so I asked them, okay, what's Reconstruction? What happened then? And 16 out of 17 of them said to me, well, that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. Oh, no. I mean, there's at least three, maybe four direct lies in that sentence. Blacks never took over the government of the southern states. The southern states had white governors throughout Reconstruction. All but one had white legislative majorities, and so on. I won't even go into the rest of them, but it convinced me that the history they had learned in high school, and I went off, and this is the beginning of my methodology, I went off to nearby high schools and watched history being taught and examined the books being used, particularly in Mississippi, in the course Mississippi History, which was required in fifth grade and again in ninth grade. Well, I did various things about that in Mississippi, but we'll cut to the American history question. When I moved after 8 years to the University of Vermont, my UVM students, as it's called, first-year students, again, I like teaching first-year students, convinced me that misknowing American history was not a Mississippi phenomenon. It was a national phenomenon. Mississippi represented it in a more exaggerated form, as Mississippi represented a lot of problems back then in a more exaggerated form, but they were national problems. So I did the same thing in Vermont. Now, I have to say most of my students, over 50%, 60% maybe, came from out of state. A bunch of them came from Connecticut, for the record. But I went to nearby schools, nearby to Burlington, Vermont high schools, and again, I watched history being taught, and I gathered 12 of the most popular American history textbooks then in use. And I then studied them carefully after watching teachers teach straight from the book. And I later found some research that shows, not anecdotally but with data, that American history is taught more from the book and the textbook is used more minutes of the hour in class than any other subject, which I think is astounding.
In your book, you said, as a result of your analysis of these 12 American history textbooks, you said the books actually make students stupid.
Yeah, they do. Shall I give you an example?
Sure.
I invented this Vietnam exercise. Let's just put it this way. In many areas, and in the case I'm talking about, questions about the Vietnam War, the more education people have, the stupider they are. That is, the worse they answer the question, the more counterfactually. And so I'm just going to let it hang there. Except I'll say this: in no other field is this true. I mean, if you look at people who take a math quiz, and let's say they're adults. It doesn't make any difference, but let's say they're adults. The more math they had in high school, the better they do on the math quiz. The same is even true in American literature, but it's not true in American history. The more history they've had and the more education they've had, the less likely they are to get lots of questions right on an American history test.
You demonstrate that some of the people that we're very familiar with are actually presented in a way, in a very inaccurate way in our books. And you talk about, for example, Helen Keller. And you say that, quote, Helen Keller, who struggled so valiantly to learn to speak, has been made mute by history. Could you talk about her?
Yeah, she did struggle, didn't she? I mean, here she was, became blind and deaf in early childhood. And she actually learned to speak, not well, but well enough to be understood. And she learned to write. And what did she use that writing for? Well, our education is usually silent about what she wrote. Books, I'll say, or she became a humanitarian. I mean, as I sometimes say to students in class, could you be more vague?
But at Radcliffe, she became very political, right?
She became very political and very left-wing. She became a socialist. And when that wasn't far enough left for her, she became a Wobbly, a member of the International Workers of the World, the socialist union that Woodrow Wilson persecuted, of course. She, when the Soviet Union occurred shortly thereafter, she flew a red flag in her study and wrote some embarrassing stuff. Let us follow the rising star in the east. Onward, comrades, onward to the rising star.
She saw that her blindness was also related to economic status. Of
yeah,
becoming
I mean,
blind.
The two are tied together, and we can maybe make fun of her today for being so left-wing, but the point is that there was something to it. She became aware that blindness is not distributed equally across the social strata, but it's concentrated in the lower class because of industrial accidents, because of bad medical care, for some women, because of syphilitic blindness, if they're prostitutes, and so on. And so she realized that if you're just going to treat blindness by doing things like improving the Braille alphabet and helping the treatment of the blind, you are treating effect, but you're ignoring cause. So that's why she went so far left.
So why did the history books leave out the last 64 years of her life?
Well, I think they do this because they think it's bad. I mean, I think they do this as a favor to Helen Keller, and of course it's just the opposite. Helen Keller would be outraged at how she's portrayed. They also leave out all kinds of other bad things. I treat Helen Keller in a chapter with Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, please talk about him, because as I read the book, I realized that Woodrow Wilson that was presented to me in high school textbooks wasn't the real Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, he's a great star as he's presented, because they leave out the two terrible things he did in office, and of course he was in office for 8 important years. First, he was an astounding foreign interventionist. At my website, and folks can go to my website, the best way to find it is just to type my name, James W. Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, into a search engine with quotation marks around it. My website will come up right up at the top. And you can take a quiz there, and it's a hilarious quiz. It's the most fun quiz you'll ever fail, but you will fail it. And one of the questions has to do with Woodrow Wilson. And it lists about 6 or 8 countries, and it says, which one of these countries did Woodrow Wilson not invade? And it turns out he invaded 7 of them, and some of the ones he invaded Mexico a total of 13 different times during his administration. He invaded many Caribbean and Latin American countries, and then he topped it off by invading the Soviet Union. And he did this really secretly. I mean, regardless of what we may think about the propriety of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, and I talk about that later in the book, at least he did bring it to Congress, and Congress did sign off on it. But Woodrow Wilson not only didn't bring his invasion of the Soviet Union to Congress, he tried to hide it from Congress.
And, of course, he also had this anti-civil liberties program.
And the second, yes, he had anti-civil liberties and even worse against civil rights. His racism was astounding. I think he's the most racist president in the history of the country after the end of slavery, that is, after Buchanan's administration.
You mentioned he segregated the civil service.
He segregated the civil service. He segregated the Navy. What this meant was black folks were mostly fired. They no longer could be, for instance, postal carriers in many places. They couldn't be mail sorters, or if they were, they were behind a screen or in a separate room. He kept them out of many jobs that they had kind of routinely gotten as patronage jobs under the Republicans, like Register of the Treasury, which is a rather high job, and port collector in New Orleans. But he did worse than that. He told nigger jokes in cabinet meetings. He loved the movie Birth of a Nation, which is a seriously racist movie, but also a wonderful cinematic advance for its time. It's the first great movie epic. And this helps, both this and Wilson's kind of racism from the top, helped cause the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, now you see, he after his term ended, he was actually very unpopular in the 1920s, but then was sort of resurrected.
Don't realize that when he left office, he was massively unpopular. I mean, Warren Harding won what is still the largest landslide to this day. If you look at the proportion of the vote he got compared to the proportion of the vote Wilson got,
Harding
wins the prize.
1920, yeah.
Yeah, and Harding is hardly a sterling president or a sterling candidate. So this was really a repudiation of Wilson, and for good reason, because he had another thing that, and here he is a successful president in terms of the war. So it's really quite amazing that his Democratic successor does so poorly in 1920. But it's not so amazing when you realize that he was such a bad president in these three ways: civil rights, civil liberties, and invading all kinds of other countries.
But after World War II, he's kind of held up as
exactly.
a great hero.
Now, how and it really shows how we see history is colored so much by who we are and what the times we live in. And now, in the 1940s and 50s, and for that matter, the 60s and into the 2000s or whatever we're in, the notion that we have not only the right but the obligation and ought to be in invading all kinds of other countries is commonplace.
Well, he represents what you call the process of heroification. Somehow we need heroes, so our leaders have to be put on a pedestal.
Yeah, and that's the same thing that happened with Helen Keller. I mean, almost everybody who's treated in American history textbooks is converted into a hero. There's one main exception, and that would be John Brown. But almost everybody else, regardless of what they did, is converted into a hero. Franklin W. Pierce is my favorite example. He's my candidate for the second worst president of all time. He was so bad that when he came back to New Hampshire, from which he's the only president ever elected, there wasn't even somebody to meet him. They thought he was terrible. But do any textbooks say anything like that about Franklin W. Pierce? They don't want to say anything bad because they might offend somebody. I mean, there's now a Franklin W. Pierce College in New Hampshire, so they've kind of forgotten that he was terrible and now claim him as the only president from New Hampshire. So you wouldn't want to not get your book adopted because you offended somebody in New Hampshire. So let's not say anything bad about Franklin W. Let's not say anything bad about Woodrow Wilson. Let's not say anything bad about anybody.
An important phase of American history that you talk about in your book has to do with the Native Americans. And you write, quote, "Apart from the European invasion itself, the pestilence is surely the most important event in the history of America." Could you talk about disease and the Native Americans?
The number one thing that the Pilgrims were thankful for was this huge pestilence that had struck the natives of New Hampshire. Excuse me. It did strike New Hampshire, but I've got New Hampshire on the brain. Massachusetts, just before they set foot, it struck it maybe in 1617 or 18. And native people were swept by plague after plague. Now, I have to say, and these plagues account for the following fact. If you look around the world in 1892, say, white folks dominate almost every country. The two big exceptions would be maybe Ethiopia and Japan. But they dominate China, they dominate India, of course, they dominate all of Africa, they dominate the Americas, Australia, and so on. But if you look around in 1992, 100 years later, China is now run by Chinese, India is run by Indians, Africa is run by Africans. I mean, you can make arguments about neocolonialism, but they're running the government, at least formally. Not so in the Americas, and not so, for that matter, in Hawaii and Australia and New Zealand. Why? Well, because these areas, having been detached from Eurasia, the people there were remarkably healthy. They didn't have livestock in the main, and they didn't have, therefore, the diseases that keep getting passed back and forth between people and the animals that they keep. And as a result, when the Europeans and Africans did arrive on the Western Hemisphere shores, they rapidly communicated diseases to the native inhabitants that almost wiped them out. Now that's, I really am serious, that's the most important, or one of the two most important geopolitical occurrences in the last millennium.
You say it may have been as many as 98% of the Native Americans that died.
Yeah, certainly 90 to 95% of the whole hemisphere. I mean, if you look at the population estimates, well, for instance, Columbus sets foot on Haiti in 1493. Well, he sets foot on it in 1492, but he comes back to take it, to occupy it in 1493. And at that point, my estimate for the population of Haiti would be 3 million. Some people estimate as high as 8 million, but I think 3 million is probably about right. Well, by 1560, which is just 65 years after Columbus arrives, the native population of Haiti is zero. Now, that's a phenomenon. That's complete genocide, although it's not on purpose. So I'm not sure you should call it that, but it's a complete population wipeout.
But it's not covered in the textbooks.
Well, you know, I have to say this. My new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me is not only based on my intensive reading of 12 textbooks, but I've now read an additional 6 to bring it up to date. And every chapter has been revised, and all of these textbooks are written after the year 2000. And the biggest single improvement that they make is in the treatment of what we call the Columbian Exchange. And that's this stuff. Not only the bringing of diseases across the ocean, and maybe to some degree the opposite direction. It may be that syphilis came to Europe from the Americas. We're not quite sure. But also the bringing of livestock, the bringing of gold and silver from west to east, the bringing of ideas in both directions, ideas like democracy going from west to east, Christianity going from east to west, and so on. Now, the textbooks amazingly completely left out this exchange, whether of disease or gold and silver or livestock or corn and potatoes or whatever, in the first batch of textbooks that I read. In the second batch, these new textbooks, that's the biggest single improvement they make. They now treat it with one exception, and that is they still completely leave out the notion of an exchange of ideas. And that's too bad. That's a shame.
We had talked earlier about foreign interventions, and you write about American history textbooks, quote, see our policies as part of a morality play in which the U.S. typically acts on behalf of human rights, democracy, and the American way, end quote.
Yeah.
How does that square with reality?
Well, I think everybody over the age of 8 knows that we don't. It's certainly true that we sometimes try to, but it's also true that often we don't try to, and I'm not even sure that we should try to. That is to say, nations usually try to act in their own self-interest.
Do textbooks, for example, cover the American-backed coups in Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54?
Pretty much they do not. There's a couple of, you know, individual exceptions that will have a sentence or two about one or another thing, but they do not treat how we stuck the Shah back up on the throne, how we gave chemical weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein and things like that.
How about the role of multinational corporations?
Pretty much not. Again, in Chile, of course, multinationals played a major role. American based multinationals in the unseating of the Allende government. And not only did they, but so did our government. Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State at the time, said at one point he didn't see any reason to let Chile go communist, even if its people voted that way. It wasn't going communist, but it was going socialist. It was going kind of the same way Bolivia has recently gone. And so, with the permission of the United States, people in Chile killed Allende, and replaced him, of course, with an odious dictator who lasted another 20 years and is just one more bad friend the United States had.
Another area that seems that you note that is omitted from textbooks is the question of social class. You say it's really taboo. Why? What does that mean?
Yeah. I've talked with a woman at Scholastic Books, an intelligent, nice person whose, among other claims to fame, is that she has edited more American history textbooks than any other living person. I'm not sure that's what you want to put on your tombstone. but she has. And, excuse me, she said there are 3 great taboos in American history publishing. And I was able to guess 2 of them, sex and religion. But I was floored by the third, and the third was social class. And I said, geez, you know, that's about 40% of what we teach in sociology. And I don't mean to be mean about it. It's just a fact that social class influences everything we do. It influences whether you're likely to have hired a lawyer. It influences whether you're likely to have been in the Boy Scouts. It influences all kinds of things. How much TV you watch per week in a negative direction. The higher the social class, the less TV. How long you're going to live. You're going to be buried.
Do they tend to exaggerate the possibility of social mobility?
The textbooks pretty much leave out social class, and they leave it out by not talking about class at all. And when they do talk about class, that's exactly what they do. They say America, unlike Europe, has very little class system. We're pretty much all middle class, and there's plenty of social mobility. Well, it turns out that that's not true, that in about 1905 or 1910, the United States passed European countries in becoming more stratified, and now we're quite dramatically more stratified than Great Britain, than Japan, than the Scandinavian countries, of course. They are stratified, but we are much more stratified, and that means it's much harder for somebody from the working class to make it into, say, the lower upper class.
In a related matter, you say there's virtually no labor history in the last 50 years covered in the textbooks.
Yeah, in a way they teach labor history, but without social class, which I think is kind of like teaching the footnotes without the text. I mean, they don't teach any in the last 50 years. I just caught your question. That's right. The last thing they really talk about pretty much is Taft-Hartley back in about 1950 or 54.
So it kind of gives people the idea that a labor union is an anachronism.
That's right. That's right. And that's why we need this book. There's a book published called From the Folks Who Brought You the Weekend that's about labor history. Because many of my students, now University of Vermont, I'm not there anymore, but I taught there for 21 years, and many of my students at the University of Vermont were very rich. It's the most expensive state school, or was for many years, in the U.S., and its out-of-state tuition is even higher, of course. And so rich folks, on the whole, go there. And they not only don't have any sympathy for the working class, they see it as a not just an anachronism, but as a pernicious thing full of corruption and bad political influence that ought to be done away with. They don't really have any idea that the labor movement did bring us the working class. They also didn't have any idea of how badly some people at their very university, like the janitors and the secretaries and so on, were paid. There's tremendous stratification in America still to be dealt with, and the textbooks pretend that we're not stratified.
You say that educators and textbooks seem to want to inculcate the next generation into blind allegiance to our country. Could you expand on that?
Well, that's evident even just from the title. I've asked people all across the United States, what was your chemistry textbook called? And they usually don't know, or they say, chemistry. And they're right. It is usually called chemistry, or introduction to chemistry, or principles of chemistry. Even in American literature, you get a title like reader in American literature. Not so in history. You, in history, get titles like Rise of the American Nation, which after we lost the war in Vietnam, became retitled Triumph of the American Nation. We get titles like the American Pageant, the Great Republic, and so on. Well, of the six new textbooks, incidentally, every single one of them is red, white, and blue on the cover, and four of them have the American flag on it itself. So I submit to you, they're trying to get you to be nationalist, to salute the flag, while learning about the past. And those two goals are sometimes in conflict. I mean, it's as if kind of your chemistry textbook was called Triumph of the Molecule. But you know it's not. You're just supposed to learn chemistry, but you're not just supposed to learn and think about history. You're also supposed to be becoming a 200% American, a nationalist.
You speculate on why history textbooks are so badly written, and you say, quote, perhaps the adults' biggest reason for lying about American history is that they fear if children were to learn what has really gone on, they would lose all respect for our society.
Well, I don't think that's true. That is, I don't think that our history has been so bad that if we faced it honestly, that would turn off the next generation and they'd run off to Russia or Canada or something like that.
That's the fear is really unfounded.
Yes. I think the problem really is that the people writing the textbooks don't have intellectual integrity. Therefore, the truth is not as important to them as it should be.
James Loewen, interviewed by Ken McDermott Rowe. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. To conclude our history segment, King David Mackenzie introduces two songs about another period of history little known in America. The first song is performed by Chumbawamba, the next by Radio Toast.